Alright, a halfway intermission. What is going to happen on the 18th of August is that Propertyn Bros is going to have a collab webinar with UOB, and we're going to talk about some deep dive trends in the landed property market. So you can click on the link right down below to register your interest for this free webinar. It's a collaboration between PLB and UOB, and we're going to have like probably a 1 hour webinar session to deep dive into the landed market current trends in the year 2021 and moving forward. So we hope to see you there on the webinar itself, and do remember to register, and we see you soon. Cheers. Okay, so we're back with Nuggets on the Go, episode number 8, I think, and welcome back. Hope that you're enjoying our 2021 series Nuggets on the Go so far. So we ended with episode number 7 talking about what is some of our definition on how we look at risk in real estate. Just to recap, we mentioned that risk in real estate in episode 7 is our own definition in PLB is that if you were to purchase a property with zero growth for appreciation, that's considered risk in a sense, because investment by definition is to put your money into an asset that has appreciation growth in the mid to long term, especially in property where it's classified as an asset that is a little bit more illiquid, because the moment you buy, especially a property in Singapore, you need to hold it for at least 3 years. Then you can exit from the market if we're talking about a private residential market, because there's a 3-year seller stamp duty involved. And if you were to exit within that 3 years, you'll be taxed with the seller stamp duty tax, which is definitely not something that we want. And thus, usually in Singapore, everybody will hold their residential private properties for at least 3 years. And because of that fact, the market in Singapore is fairly stable, because everybody buy already with a presumption that they will at least hold it for 3 years. And thus, you will very seldom see people sell within that first, second year and third year mark. Thus, actually, cooling measures on the flip side, basically good for the market, because it stabilizes the volatility of the market. And you will seldom see people having to do fire sale as well, because right now, based on TDSR check, there's a 60% kind of like haircut already on the assessment of every individual before they are allowed to take a bank loan to finance their mortgage. And on top of that, we also have to put in a 25% down payment and stamp duty, making up to close to about 29%. So everybody has already technically done their due diligence before they actually commit to a property. Now, what we want to talk about today is a very interesting topic. So recently, I was reading on this blog on Sidley that talk about how do I go about saving 100K by 30 years old? And I think it's a pretty interesting topic, because it is also a topic that is relating to, you know, if, let's say, example, you were to be just graduated from university, and you're planning, hey, you know, how much do I need to save in order to buy my first property? This topic is just really sinking into the same kind of trajectory, because how much you can save, how much you can build in a CPF as a Singaporean, it contributes to the speed on how fast you can actually purchase your first property. Typically, in terms of this entire graph, we're going to draw this graph. For guys, you are typically going to graduate at the age of around 25 or maybe 26, depending. Whether you go to junior college or polytechnic, and then you have to serve 2 years in the army, and then by the time when you start school, depending on 3 or 4 year program, you're typically going to graduate at about age 25. And then that's the year that you will start working at 25, 26. For ladies, that'll be a little bit earlier, 2 years earlier than guys, probably about 23 years old, thereabout. And thus, if you will look at this trajectory towards the lifespan that we have usually, from the age of 25 all the way to age of 65, why do we take 65 as a gauge? Is because when you take a mortgage from the bank, they usually look at 65 years old, less of your current age, and then they will max out the tenure based on 30 years maximum. Although if you were to refinance at a later stage, there are some strategies that you can actually stretch your tenure to 75, but that's a whole lot different topic together. Today, we'll just focus on how banks assess your loan eligibility and your loan tenure. So let's say you are 25 years old, even if you have the capital to buy the property, they will take 65 minus 25, that'll be 40, but they will still cut it down to 30 max tenure for you to own your first property. So that's the initial bank loan that you will take. But of course, when you buy a property, let me just put a hypothetical example. Let's say if it's a $1 million property, a very quick shortcut to calculate on how much you need in terms of down payment is that 25% will be down payment. Oh, 25%, 5% will be cash. 20% can be cash or CPF. You need to set aside an additional 4% for stamp duty if the property is at least $1 million and above. If it's below $1 million, it's 3%, but there's a small little calculation caveat. Take 4% minus 15,400 or 3% minus 5,400. So for this example, the quick shortcut is that, let's say you go and see a property. If the property is $1 million, just take out a calculator, take $1 million times 29% and less of 15,400. That will be the amount that you need to prepare in order to buy the property. Of course, there's some small little additional amount like legal fee, and also there's the valuation fee as well. So set aside perhaps about another $3,000 to $4,000 for that range. Also take note that your stamp duties can also be paid through your CPF amount if it's a new launch. If it's a resale, it can also be paid through a CPF amount. The only thing is that when you first purchase a resale property, you have to pay that stamp duty in cash first. And when the property is completed, your lawyer can actually claw back the amount from your CPF OA account back to you. So in the end, you can still use CPF. It's just that at the start point, you need to have that cash ready. So something for you to take note, all these small little minute details. We have other investor series and R series that talks about all these things in detail. Coming back here, this means that when you buy a $1 million property, you need to have at least $274,600 to prep yourself in terms of cash and CPF. Minimum cash component is definitely already 50,000. The balance can be from CPF. But what does this mean for a young adult, a young person that just come out of society and then you got a first job and you're planning in advance? Okay, but before that, maybe let's head back a little bit to design. All right, so it's commercial break number two. What's going to happen at the end of August is that we're going to have a District 5 landed property webinar. And during this webinar, we're going to help one of the developers talk about some of the new landed properties that they're going to launch within the District 5, especially in the Pasir Panjang Hill region. So if you're interested to attend this webinar that we're going to have, and it's going to be a live webinar at the end of August. The specific date and time is not out yet. We're still finalizing the details. But if you would like to attend this webinar, and especially if you're interested in the freehold landed property in the District 5 region, and that's walkable to the Haw Par Villa MRT station, keep a lookout for the webinar. And the link to sign up is actually on the description box down below. I'm going to flash it down here as well. So when you sign up, they're going to bring you to our PLB landing page. And then you can key in your name and email. And shortly after, once the webinar link is confirmed, we're going to send you the webinar link for you to attend the live webinar with us. And we're going to chat about some of the insights on the District 5 landed property market trends, as well as talking about some of these new landed properties that the developer will be planning to launch. So we hope to see you there on the webinar. And meantime, take care. Okay, but before that, maybe let's head back a little bit to define what are the different generations. And then based on Wikipedia, there's like Gen X. Okay, it's from 1965 to 1980. And of course, I belong to Gen Y, 1981 to 1995. That's also called the millennials. Of course, Gen Z, 1996 to 2012. And guess what? Right now, Ethan belongs to Gen Alpha. 2013 onwards, they are considered Gen Alpha according to Wikipedia. But let's go back to scenario one. Assuming you're single, you're not getting married, drawing a salary, what are your property options? Can you buy a BTO? No, you cannot buy a BTO unless you are at 35 years old, which is 10 years later. And if you want to buy a BTO at age 35 as single, you can only go for a two-room BTO. You have to be at least 35 years old to qualify for a resale HDB. You can buy up to an executive apartment and stuff like that. It's just that there are some additional terms and conditions where you can only take bank loans and stuff. Also a whole lot different topic. But the key is that you must be at least 35. So if you're 25, you cannot touch HDB property as a single person. So what are your options? You can only go for a private property if we are talking about residential property. And a lot of times, 25 to 35 is the years, are these 10 years for you to save up. So it depends very strongly on what industry are you in, what kind of salary range are you drawing. But let's refer back to this blog article that we talked about. Very interestingly, I'm going to flesh out this chart for you. So the link to the full article is right down below. So it talks about the fact that if you start off with a graduate salary at a median range of maybe $2,900 per month, after CPF, you take home $2,320, and then you save half of your take-home salary, you're going to be able to save $16,240 per year, including your 13-month bonus in cash. By age 30, if you can diligently save 50% of your monthly take-home salary, you will be able to save $104,526 after 6 years of working full-time. And this is, of course, assuming you have no job lapse and assuming that your salary is increasing at a 4% salary increment for the next 6 years. So, basically, your cash savings is not sufficient to buy a property yet at 30 years old. But we also have to take into account your CPF amount. So, after 6 years, that is the estimated CPF sum in your CPF ordinary account. So, take note, you contribute 20% CPF. Your employer contributes an additional 17% CPF. So basically, this 17% is on top of the salary that is shown, right? So if it's 2009 plus CPF, employer contribute another 17%. Out of this 37%, certain percentage will be going to your OA, SA, and MediSave account. And the amount that you can use for property is only from the OA account. And let's take this example and pump into this data for the next 6 years. So basically, this CPF build up in over the next 6 years, we have to take into account the accrued interest that you have earned from CPF OA account, which is 2.5% per annum. Roughly estimation, if I don't count your 13-month bonus, you will be able to get save up probably close to about 60,000 after 6 years in your CPF OA account. And then adding back to the 104,000, that will then bring us to close to about 164,000 thereabout. And this is still insufficient to buy a $1 million property. Why do we say 1 million? It's because right now, in the year 2021, if you were to go ahead and look at all the new launches in the market, if we talk about new launch residential properties, you cannot find any two bedders that's below a million. The only thing you can buy below a million is these are all one bedders and they are like 900,000 range. So our pricing in terms of benchmark prices for brand new residential properties is really inching up. It has inched up for the last 2 years, especially after the latest Pasir Ris hit. Very, very good performance for the launch. I think this weekend is like a lot of developers, they are like sort of raising prices based on what we're seeing on the ground. Initially, we thought that there's a chance for resale and new launch to close up a bit, but now it seems like new launch is also starting to inch upwards already because a lot of the balance inventory has been cleared over the past 6 months as the market has been doing really well. So we think that resale still has some room to grow in a sense. And we'll continue to monitor the market and update you guys. Okay, but back to this topic. So if by age 30, cash and CPF, you can save up to about 166,000, it means that you can't still afford like a $1 million property because you need a minimum of 276,000. So if you want to calculate based on 166, what you can buy, very simply, you just take 166 divided by 0.28. Because technically, below a million, you take a 28% down payment plus stamp duty. That's the quick calculation method. So you take 166 divided by 0.28. That'll be the amount of the property that you can buy. And as we elongate that to 10 years, using that same formula from the cash savings and CPF savings, that will mean that at the end of 10 years, when you're age 35, your CPF will then build up to about 120,000 and your cash, you can potentially build up to close to 200,000, provided you use the same formula, say 50% of your take-home pay, salary increase by 4%, you never get out of job. By the time you're age 35, you have saved up about $320,000. And then, using that formula again, 320,000 divided by 0.29 plus 15,400. Okay. So you can buy something up to about $1.1 million kind of range. So very comfortable, you can then own a property at about 1 mil. But of course, we then have to take into consideration that in 10 years time, let's say if you're now age 25, 10 years time, age 35, how much will our property price be? We'll be in the year 2031. And definitely at this rate of growth, perhaps by that time, $1 million will also be a little bit challenging. These are things that, of course, it will happen in the future. We won't know yet. But this is the typical route to save up probably up to about 300,000 based on some parameters right here. So of course, that's scenario one. Why do we talk about this? Is because this is going to lead us to the next two scenarios whereby the speed, of course, to get your first property will then be accelerated if you are getting married. Because when you're getting married, as long as both of you, you and your spouse are above 21, you can apply for BTO. You can go for resale HDB. And in Singapore, the CPF grants for first-timer resale HDB and the subsidy plus grant for first-timer BTO buyers are a lot. For example, if you're a first-time couple, just got married, matrimonial property, first time buying a resale HDB, your grants can be up to 160,000. And that essentially is already the first bullet for you to put in the down payment. And if you get a HDB loan, you can loan up to 90%. So let's say if you buy a 600,000 resale HDB, you only need 60,000 as down payment, which is already covered in your CPF housing grant. And that's how our government help couples to get their first property at a faster rate. And of course, in Singapore, government policy is to encourage people to build families and things like that. So thus, the HDB properties, which are meant as public housing to encourage different forms of policies, right? So, of course, we'll leave it as that. But what we're trying to say is that there are scenarios 1, 2, and 3. As a single person, what are your options? As a married couple, what are your options? As a couple that maybe you're not intending to go for a HDB property, what are your options for private residential? And thus, we're going to talk about this scenario 2 and 3 in the next topic. But right now, I want to end off this episode with scenario 1. That means coming back to the fact that if you're single and let's say you manage to save up even more, perhaps you got a better high-paying job, you run a business, you're self-employed, or maybe your career is doing well, or you manage to invest in maybe stocks, bonds, and stuff like that, and then you manage to build up your capital faster, even before reaching age 65. What we're seeing on the ground is that we think that it's also very important to not hastily just buy any property because your overall quantum budget is limited and you go ahead and buy, let's say, a property which is very hard to exit in 3 to 5 years. We've seen many times before single buyers because of the fact that they want to rush in and quickly own the property and they just pick up based on the limited budget they have. And they go for, let's say, a very smallish property. And then by 3 years or 5 years' time, when they want to sell, some of them, they approach us and they ask us for our opinions and advice. Like, hey, why is it that, you know, I bought a one bedder, but after 5 years, there's no appreciation. We have to perhaps take a more helicopter scope and understand a little bit on the ground on what is actually happening because we can feel the ground on top of statistics based on the amount of viewings and everything that we do on a weekly basis by our sales team. Now, the key rationale is because sometimes there are two varying factors on top of many different factors. One is that if you go for smaller apartments, because the square footage is smaller, even though if, let's say, the project has an incremental increase of $100 per square foot, what's going to happen is, let's say, you buy a 400 square feet apartment and you buy in at $2,000 per square foot. If the project increased by $100 per square foot, that would mean that your property has appreciated by 40,000. But 40,000 is not enough to cover your bank interest, your renovation, your stamp duty, and things like that. And thus, even if you were to increase by $200 per square foot, that will have increased by 80,000. And thus, like 3-5 years later, when you want to sell the property, after you calculating, you add back everything. You add back your legal fee, stamp duty, you add back your commission to pay to your broker that helps you to market and viewings and things like that, and you add back your bank interest, you'll find that it's technically like a net loss or you just break even. And thus, it's also very important to determine, is this property for your own use? Because if it's your own use, you're definitely the person paying the installment. If you rent out, then there's still additional rental income to cover. The most important thing is to understand that the smaller the size of the property, the smaller the square footage, even though you see an appreciation in terms of per square foot for the entire development, the amount in terms of quantum appreciation is limited. compared to a larger apartment, let's say 1,000 square feet, a $200 per square foot increment will be equivalent to a $200,000 quantum appreciation. And thus, the size does matter. And the second thing is that we always advocate buying something that you already can sort of forecast and foresee. Of course, not to 100% set certainty, but you know that 3-5 years later, when you want to exit, the audience that is willing to buy a property is larger than the audience that will buy another type of property that you initially thought about. So in Singapore, we have to look at the demographics, which is why we always look at OCR, RCR, and CCR. We look at different districts. We look at what are the predominant demographics there. For example, is this district having a support pool of HDB upgraders families? And that would mean that are there a lot of HDB BTOs? What are the prices of the HDB flats doing right there? Do they make a profit? And thus, if I know that the property that I'm going to buy has a support level, then perhaps I want to go for a 3-bedder because I want to be able to exit to an audience that will love my product. I don't want to buy a 1-bedder in an estate with a lot of HDB BTOs. And then after 3 or 5 years, when I want to put a property in the market, the 1-bedder has no audience because all the potential buyers, they're all coming to at least own a 3-bedder because they're upgrading for HDB. They're married. They have 1 to 2 or 3 kids. They need at least 3 bedrooms to function as a livable space. And thus, when we buy properties in certain areas, when you look at launches, when you look at resale properties, study the demographics of the district, the zoning, the area. Look at the demographics currently and try to forecast in 3, 5 years, 8 years' time when your property is being put to the market. Is this product something that a lot of people will want to own? Because if you go in and buy a property hastily and then you find that 3-5 years later, when you want to exit, it's very difficult, then the challenge will come in right then. So you want to be able to forecast first. Of course, what I'm saying is that I'm not saying that 1 or 2 bedders are no good. In fact, I myself own a 2-bedder, right? I love properties that has very high tenancy kind of return. And 1-bedders and 2-bedders are very easy to rent out because there's very high fluidity and the overall rental quantum is much lower. And I'm not saying also that 3 and 4 bedders is not easy to rent. It all depends on a lot of different parameters. But what we're trying to say is that there are districts and places to hunt for 1-bedders and 2-bedders. There are districts and places that are more suitable for 3 or 4 bedders. And more suitable is in the sense of we are talking about the exit speed. So if you want a higher and fastest exit speed, you want more buyer audience, then hunt for the right product in the right district, in the right zoning. Thank you for staying tuned with us on Nuggets on the Go. We hope to see you soon on the next episode. Meantime, take care and ciao.